Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do smart people make stupid decisions? From the extramarital relationships that shattered the careers of prominent politicians, to the small potatoes insider trading that sent Martha Stewart to jail, to the rage-filled driving styles that make roadways more dangerous for all of us, it seems there is no shortage of Americans willing to risk their relationships, careers, even personal safety for the sake of an ill-considered action. My guest today says there are clear reasons for those bad choices, which are a product of both societal factors and personal responsibility, or lack thereof. William B. Helmreich is a writer and sociologist. His new book is called What Was I Thinking? The Dumb Things We Do and How to Avoid Them. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You write that dumb mistakes involve taking risks that just aren't worth it. Can you talk a little about that?
Well, there are so many of them, and they go from the high to the low, from well-known people like Bill Clinton to the rest of us. Road rage, for example, which you mentioned, is an excellent example. Somebody cuts you off, you get angry, you chase after them, and then when you wind up in a hospital with two broken legs, you start wondering, why did I do that? What was I thinking? We tend to overreact in many situations, and then we're sorry. We sue a plumber over a $75 repair. We win in court, but it takes us 10 hours, and then we wonder why we did it. We tell our boss off. We're fired the next day. We wonder why we said what was on our mind. And so they're really, really common mistakes, but they're mistakes made by the high and mighty, too, because they're often not thinking when they do something.
And you definitely think personal responsibility plays a role here, but you also believe we have to look at broader patterns within society to understand why we do these things.
It is a mix, really, of the two. I don't think we can say that individuals are not responsible for their actions because at some point you have to make decisions, and we teach our own children to make decisions. We punish people because they make incorrect decisions, but at the same time, society does play a role. Our environment determines a lot of things about who we are, what we are, why we do what we do. Take, for example, Michael Vick. Mm-hmm. Michael Vick was involved in dogfighting, and a lot of people found it very reprehensible, and understandably so, especially people who love animals and people who think you should do the right thing. On the other hand, the problem for Vick was he came from a subculture that didn't see anything seriously wrong with it, and that's part of the problem. We don't live in one culture in America. There are people who collect stamps. There are people who love certain actors. There are people who belong to gangs. There are people who belong to all sorts of clubs, and each one thinks that within their group what they're doing is correct and they're right, but when they step out of the group, they're sometimes in for a rude awakening.
You also say it helps to look at our childhood and the values that we were raised with and exposed to. What kinds of experiences and attitudes tend to stick with people after they've grown up?
The ones where they either are very much rewarded or the ones where they pay a very heavy price. Mm-hmm. When that happens, you learn the lesson best, unfortunately.
Let's talk about the culture of celebrity here for a minute. There is no shortage of rich and famous people caught doing bad things. What affects how we interpret those actions and whether we see them as justification for our own moral failings or we simply see the person's decision as really bad?
It's a very good question, Chris, because it really depends on how we see life in general and what we're thinking about before. Often what happens is we fit the actions into our own cynicism, into our own idealism, into things that we want to believe are true. And sometimes we say, well, what do you expect? Let's take the Barry Bonds trial now. He's accused of using steroids, and a lot of people say, well, what do you expect? But that's the problem. The problem is, if Barry Bonds is just an unlikable fellow, and he ends up being prosecuted for this and ends up being found guilty, then society will say, well, great, we solved the problem. And a lot of people who want to believe in baseball, who want to believe in the viability of sports, will go back to doing what they did before and say, okay, we punished the culprits. The problem is, we didn't really punish the culprits because there were probably over 100 people in baseball using steroids. Hmm. And he becomes the fall guy. Now, George Mitchell got it right. when former Senator Mitchell ran the investigation, he decided that society was at fault and that therefore we couldn't blame one person. Well, that's true, but if we did blame society, then who really has to take responsibility for that? At the same time, we live in a culture that's very interdependent, and if we had indicted 100 players and tossed them out of the sport, there'd be empty stadiums, there'd be baseball players out of work, there'd be baseball owners losing tens of millions of dollars. The effects of looking the other way for wrongdoing are sometimes beneficial, even though we may not agree with it.
What about the public humiliation that Bonds is undergoing, regardless of how this all ends up? Is that a cautionary tale for our own lives?
It's a cautionary tale, except for the fact that we see Bonds as a person with an outside ego, as a person who has displayed by his acts of temper an attitude that he doesn't really care what anybody thinks.
So he's so much worse than us that we don't relate.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We can't relate to him because we would be humiliated. We wouldn't find ourselves in that position. We wouldn't make threats against our girlfriend as he did in the trial and everything else if we were not Barry Bonds. So in order for you to identify or not identify with somebody, you really have to relate to him. But there is a symbiotic relationship between ourselves and the role models that we choose to turn into role models, which is that we need our heroes, and they in turn need us. We need them because if they falter, who are we going to look up to? Who are we going to tell our children to look up to? But when they falter, we're really at a loss for words, and we have to find ways of rationalizing it. On the other hand, the role models need us, too. They need us to give them the approval. Unfortunately, that sometimes gets taken too far. So you have people like Charlie Sheen who are surrounded by enablers, people who tell them they're great, sycophants, and as a result, these people think that they can do no wrong.
You know, I heard a group of friends actually having a debate over whether or not Charlie Sheen could come back from this whole thing. And it is true, as you note in the book, we see humiliated stars making comebacks all the time and being celebrated for it. So the price of scandal doesn't necessarily last forever.
The price of scandal doesn't last forever, but the person's reputation is tarnished. Take Elliot Spitzer.
Mm-hmm.
People say, well, he's not doing bad. He has a show, although he lost his partner a while ago, but he does have a TV show. But how do you compare that with a person who was once touted as a possible vice presidential candidate, as a person who was governor of an entire state? Bill Clinton, impeached by the House, not by the Senate, has a worldwide reputation as a globe-trotting statesman. Yes, that's true, but he still is tarnished by what he did. And the interesting thing, Chris, is that a lot of these people never thought they'd have to pay the price.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, they live in a delusionary world. They believe their own publicity.
That's the remarkable thing to me about the Bill Clinton story. And we're talking, obviously, we're referring to the Monica Lewinsky scandal. It seems so obvious to us that someone would get caught doing that.
Well, he had a history of getting away with this for a long time. And from Jennifer Flowers and on to many other people, what happens is, when you're in that position, you tend to think that things are somehow going to work out. After all, you're the world's most powerful person. As you may know, I did research for Bill Clinton many, many years ago when he lost his reelection campaign in Arkansas. And I came down with a group of people who were consultants and were trying to give him advice about what to do so that he could win again, because he knew if he lost once more, he'd be finished, and he never would have been president.
Mm-hmm.
And we told him that when you make a mistake, you have to admit that you made a mistake. His response was, my daddy never had to whip me more than once for doing something wrong, for doing the same thing wrong. And I thought he learned from that lesson. But 15 years later, the first thing he said was, I did not have sex with that woman. And he obviously was forced to recant that later on. What had happened was, in the intervening period of time, he had become arrogant. And that's the difference between being a governor of Arkansas and being president of the United States. But, you know, if you read his autobiography, My Life, carefully, you see that there are signs there that things were going wrong. He talked about his own feelings of worthlessness, the contradiction between him as the good Clinton and the bad Clinton, and that it was a constant struggle for him. And he always felt very guilty about things that he did. He said that when he decided not to go to Vietnam, he knew that somebody else was going to take his place. But you see, he has a certain personality trait, which is that he fancies himself in the public eye to be something of a rogue, something of a charmer, something of a seducer. And that's in direct contrast to a man like Eliot Spitzer, who is seen as a not very nice fellow, not very warm and fuzzy, not a charmer. He's more a taker. He's more a crusader. He's more a fire and brimstone type of guy. That type of person doesn't resonate very well with the public. And as a result, when he ran afoul of things, he didn't really get a lot of mercy. He didn't get a lot of understanding. And he hasn't been able to really reinvent himself since then.
The Clinton story also comes back to something you write about here, which is that you find that many people who have who are hyper ambitious, we can put it that way, they tend to have parents who have experienced great trauma. How does that breed kids who are so driven to succeed at all costs?
Well, in one sense, we're trying to make up for the failures of our parents. In another situation, we know that our parents are counting on us to make up for their failures. And that brings tremendous pressure. On the other hand, there are plenty of parents who are very successful who also imbue their children with a desire to do the same, with a desire to emulate them. So it's really complicated because it's a question of the meshing of the child's personality with that of the father. That's why in the same family sometimes children turn out different. We can't always control that, and we can't always predict it.
What about this phenomenon, Bill, that we feel like everybody else is doing the wrong thing? So even though we might find it reprehensible, we think, well, why should I be losing out on this fun, this opportunity, this thing?
Well, there really is truth to that. I mean, it was one of the most common refrains that I heard when I did the interviews, the many interviews that I conducted for this book, which is that there's a deep cynicism about our system. And it's coupled with an acceptance that this is life, and anyone who doesn't think so is just naive. On the other hand, when we hear about all the Wall Street executives who are making money while other people are out of work, we're outraged. When we hear that reporters are plagiarizing, when we hear that reporters are claiming they've been to places they've never been to, or when doctors are overcharging, we're all very, very upset. In other words, It's a combination of resigning yourself to the reality that everyone does it, to a refusal to accept it because we're outraged that other people are getting away with things that we're not getting away with. Hmm.
So we're good at recognizing iniquity in other people, but not so much in ourselves.
That's the human condition.
Is it fixable?
It is fixable. It is fixable, but you need constant reinforcement. In other words, one of the things that I counsel people in the chapter I have on how to prevent yourself from doing dumb things is to keep your true friends and listen to their advice because they're the ones that love you the most. And by true friends, I mean the people who were your friends before you succeeded, before you became famous. They're the ones who, while you might think that they're trying to cut you down and prevent you from going ahead, they are really trying to tell you, listen, I was your friend before all these other people showed up. And when I give you advice, it's really in your own best interest. I argue in the book that part of the reason that we don't really take advice from people is that we've become a society that doesn't really communicate personally as much.
Let me have you hold there. We're going to take a quick break. My guest this hour is writer and sociologist William B. Helmreich. His new book is called What Was I Thinking? The Dumb Things We Do and How to Avoid Them. Join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and sociologist William B. Helmreich. His new book is called What Was I Thinking? The Dumb Things We Do and How to Avoid Them. We're lining up your calls now at 1-800-933-5372 if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org. Another thing, another phenomenon you point out is going back to, I guess, Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone. Communities are less cohesive today than they used to be, which leaves us less susceptible to peer pressure that might keep us on the straight and narrow.
It's absolutely correct. Putnam had it right. He did studies in which he showed that people are less and less inclined to join. PTA membership was down. Church participation was declining anywhere from 25% to 50%. And the problem with that and the problem with us communicating on the Internet more and more is that when we do not have face-to-face interaction, we can't really see what's going on in other people's minds. And we lose a very important tool for understanding what people really mean. When we see somebody in the flesh, we can see if they're angry, if they're happy, if they're expressing gratitude, love, hatred, all the emotions that give us the clue, the roadmap, in terms of deciding what we should do. And when we don't have that, we don't have the opportunity, A, to recognize things that we might be about to do that are wrong, that will result in sorrow for us, and we don't have the opportunity to tell other people, are you kidding? You'll never get away with that. Calm down. Don't even do it. And very often we miss that moment. What has happened is that it's become easier for us to not communicate with people. So you call somebody when you know they're not there, so you won't have to talk to them, and then you leave them a message. Then they do the same to you. And pretty soon, your opportunities for communication have been drastically reduced. So that does play a role.
Yeah, so we're talking at each other instead of with each other.
That's correct. We're talking at each other, and in a way, we're avoiding listening to criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is that criticism is painful. I would say that a lot of the things that people do could have been avoided if they had realized the consequences before they did it. Take, for example, Mary Lee Jones. I mean, she's not exactly a household name, but she was the director of admissions at MIT, and she had a 27-year career that suddenly ended when it was discovered that she didn't not only have a PhD, she didn't even have the bachelor's degree that she claimed to have. And you have to wonder, why did this happen? Why did this woman go for so long? But you see, in her case, we had a book that she wrote, Less Stress, More Success, The Guide to College for Youngsters. And in that book, we had a rare opportunity to see what a person was thinking before somebody outed them, before somebody discovered what they did. Mm-hmm. And in it, she had things like, we shouldn't lie. What kind of an example will we be setting for our children? We should understand that what goes around comes around, and that if you live a lie, you'll never be happy. She was talking about herself, only no one knew it at the time. It was only a year later, when it came to light that she was a fraud, that we could understand that. But the point is, it was really a cry for help. Her own book was a cry for help. And very often that's what happens. As I thought about the matter of Spitzer, I thought to myself, yes, he had a certain degree of arrogance, but I think at a certain level Spitzer wanted to be caught. If he hadn't wanted to be caught, why did he use the name George Fox, one of his closest friends and biggest fundraisers, as an alias when he booked the room in the Mayflower Hotel? In fact, why did he go to the Mayflower Hotel? Very public place. And he had a state trooper waiting downstairs for him. And then when he went after people for making large cash transfers, you have to wonder why he made the same cash transfers when he was engaged in this activity. Now, I don't want to avoid the question of, why did he want to get caught? Because that's very, very important in our understanding of human behavior. And that is that the contradictions between the life he was living, the things he was doing, and the way he had been raised eventually became too much for him.
Hmm.
He wanted to go to the prostitute, but at the same time, he had been brought up in a very strict, moralistic family that frowned would be understating it, on such activity. So in the end, he basically, at the subconscious level, at the unconscious level, was dropping hints. The attitude being, if I'm caught, it's finally over. My wife will stand by me by my side. I'll receive my punishment. I'll lose my high position in life. And at the same time, if I don't get caught, then what I did was not so bad. The truth is that a lot of these people have deep feelings of insecurity and that they need constant praise and reinforcement in order to be able to go on. The problem is that if you don't deal with the insecurity, you'll keep on needing the insecurity, solved by receiving praise. The praise lasts a short time. It's never enough. Then you need another booster shot. And in reality, you never really get to the bottom of the problem. And the praise you receive doesn't even make you feel happy.
And what you're describing there, in part, it sounds like narcissism.
Pardon me?
You're describing narcissism, where people have to have this praise to function. And if they go without it for even a short amount of time, they just feel terrible.
That is narcissism, but there is a solution. There is a solution to the problem. I don't want to simply, be a naysayer. One of the solutions is to consciously make an effort to talk less about yourself. If you're the kind of person who talks about themselves a lot, it'll be very hard at first. But you'll find that the less you talk about yourself, the more people will like you. That will be a reward in of itself. And the less you'll need to do it. See if you can go 5 minutes without saying it. Or when you are talking about yourself, tape record yourself. When you see how you sound, you may not like yourself that much. And maybe that'll get you to change your behavior.
Do you find in dealing with people, Bill, that the people who need to go through this exercise are likely to recognize that?
I feel that they're more likely to recognize it when their narcissism has been punished,
uh-huh.
When they find they lose their friends, when they find they lose their influence, when they find they lose that election. You see, that's a key thing. I think that when Clinton lost his reelection effort in Arkansas, he realized that he had better do something about his behavior. And don't forget, when he was interviewed by Dan Rather and he was asked about Monica Lewinsky, he said, I did it for about the worst reason that anybody could do something. I did it because I could. And as he found out, you can't. Sometimes it's really amazing how, in search of the easy way, which is not to engage in self-criticism, we do things that we're sure to be called on. There was a candidate running for mayor of New York City who said that he was a product of the public school system, had gone to public school for 12 years.
Yeah.
He hadn't. He'd gone to parochial school for 12 years. You would think he would know that he's going to get caught on that. We had a congressperson in New York City who claimed that she graduated from Oberlin College when she didn't. And when you're in the public eye, everybody's gunning for you. People have to remember that the higher they go, envy kicks in, people gun for you and look to take you down a notch.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is William Helmreich, author of What Was I Thinking? The Dumb Things We Do and How to Avoid Them. We'll go to the phones now and speak first with Ronnie in Fort Worth. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to give a little background and then ask a question. I grew up in a home where I was terribly abused. My father was a devil. My mother stood by and watched all this happen and never did anything about it. Aunts, uncles, neighbors, a whole bunch of people that knew all about this stuff didn't do anything about it. And I consider myself to be a pretty intelligent guy. I'm well-read. But my decision-making process throughout my life has never really been, I have to admit, very good. I grew up to be a drug addict. I'm recovering now. But I guess my question is, how much does environment play with, in the thought-making process or the decision-making process, whether or not, to make good or bad decisions? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thank you, Ronnie. What do you think, Bill?
Well, I think the environment plays a tremendous role. And first of all, just by listening to you speak, Ronnie, I want to compliment you on the fact that whether you want to say it or not, I think you've probably overcome a lot of problems or you wouldn't be talking the way you are. Still, at the same time, acknowledging that you have a problem is the first step towards dealing with it. Environment plays a major role, but I think we also have to remember that people are made differently. Sometimes, for example, I found this true to be the case in education, a child will be sexually abused, and that child will suffer forever from childhood sexual abuse and the effects of it. Other children will experience the same abuse, and will go on to lead productive lives, and it will appear, I say, that they were minimally affected by it. The real problem is that when things go wrong in your life, some people have a greater capacity to recover than other people do. And that has a lot to do with their personality, with their flexibility, with support groups, and that's an environmental factor. So it's really very, very complicated.
We have an email here from Travis in Dallas who writes, I used to work at a video rental store and was verbally abused, berated, or chewed out at least once a day. Then I noticed a pattern. Every one of these encounters happened between 5 and 8 p.m. I'm pretty sure people were taking out the frustrations of their workday on me. I'm convinced many bad decisions are the result of built-up anger and frustration over time. What do you think?
In my experience running the Conflict Resolution Center at City College where I teach, I have discovered that that is very, very often the case. We have great difficulty accepting the blame for our own shortcomings. And we usually pick on people who make easy targets. That's why minorities are easy targets. That's why people who are in difficult circumstances are easy targets. And a person who had a bad day at work comes in, sees a person in the video store. What do they care? They're not going to get fired. Nothing's going to happen to them. Come home, he got chewed out at work, kick the dog. The dog can't even tell anybody.
Hmm. What makes us believe that we deserve money and success and power and the sense that it's only fair if we are sort of elevated to the status of the most powerful among us?
Well, I'm not sure that everybody believes that, but of the people who do believe it, it's a certain sense of entitlement. And that usually comes from not being asked to take responsibility for your actions when you're a child, from having doting parents, from having people who make you feel that you are God's gift to humanity. And if you are brought up to believe that, it comes as something of a rude awakening. And what happens when you refuse to recognize it is that you want to go back to that primal state when you were thought of as great. And you know how often parents tell their children, listen, the world doesn't owe you a living. The world's not going to be nice to you. When my students come late to class, for example, I tell them, I said, listen, you come late to class here. Why were you late? Etc. But when you go out into the real world, nobody's interested in why you did or didn't do something.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Phyllis in Fort Worth. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I wanted to ask your guest, I hear so many people now talking about their online communities and their friendships online, but I'm wondering, do we really, really connect with that person on a level that we would if we met them in person? One of the things that I've noticed is that it seems that we have less empathy with someone that we have not had personal contact with.
I think that this is something we touched on earlier. It's very, very critical to have human contact with people. When you have human contact with people, you see them as individuals and not as stereotypes. You see them as people who may matter to you, people who are important, people who are human just like you are. And so I would completely agree with you.
Yeah, it's really interesting, too, that people who wouldn't, I don't think, walk up to a stranger and criticize them, you know, what they're wearing or how they look, have no problem leaving an anonymous comment on a video or a website or an article or something and never really have to face the fact that a human being might read that and be hurt by it.
Well, it really shows up in a number of ways. Bumper stickers, for example.
Yeah.
They're a way of expressing your opinion without really having to take responsibility for it. I mean, people don't usually stop somebody at a light and say, why do you feel that way?
It makes your blood boil sometimes, though, doesn't it?
It sure does. And by the way, that's one of the real problems with road rage. We're walled in behind glass and steel, and we don't have a way of expressing our frustration to the person who cut us off inadvertently or on purpose. And that's why we gun the motor. And when we gun the motor, we feel a sense of power. But, of course, it's all illusionary because what happens is you can get into a lot of trouble.
You know what's so interesting about that, Bill, is that it's even harder to say you're sorry if you happen to be sorry for making a mistake in traffic. It's really easy to pound on that horn or to swerve in front of somebody, but, you know, to get their eye to sort of wave and make a face is tougher.
It's one of the most disarming things you can do. Usually when you wave to somebody, when you let them know that you feel guilty, mm-hmm. Their hearts will melt. I do a lot of research in urban areas in New York City, and when I go through some bad neighborhoods and I encounter people who might not be too friendly, I'll put it diplomatically, the first thing I do is I make eye contact with them and I say, "Hey, how you doing?" And that expression is so disarming to them that they melt. I have never had a problem in a gang area or any other neighborhood because I've dealt with the person face-to-face. It's the most important thing you can do.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Michael in Dallas. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Well, one thing that comes to mind listening to this is Carl Jung and his thoughts about the unconscious and how so much of what we do is for totally unconscious reasons, and the best we can do is kind of rationalize and come up with some sort of justification or explanation. And I just would like for your guest to, I'm wondering if he is interested in those points of view. And one other thing, you mentioned Michael Vick and his the fact that he came from a culture in which dogfighting was, well, it wasn't really looked down on, but I would wonder what you'd say about the other aspect of it was his pleasure in torturing dogs and finding creative ways of killing them. That doesn't seem like that's from a culture so much as maybe something pathological.
Thank you very much for your call, Michael.
Thank
we
you.
Need to take a break now, so I'll have Bill answer those two things after this short break. My guest this hour is William B. Helmreich. He is a writer and sociologist whose new book is called What Was I Thinking? The Dumb Things We Do and How to Avoid Them. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and sociologist William B. Helmreich. His new book is called What Was I Thinking? The Dumb Things We Do and How to Avoid Them. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, we had these questions about how this all relates to Carl Jung's ideas about the unconscious and also a little more about Michael Vick. Do you want to tackle those, Bill?
Yes. Surely, with pleasure. First of all, it was Sigmund Freud who actually said that the unconscious never lies. It's that part of the brain that represents what we would like to do, but we've been raised to feel guilty about doing it. And that includes anxieties, repressed thoughts, all sorts of desires, you name it. But the problem is that we can't always control it. And when that happens, we act out of character. I think back of Lisa Nowak, who
this is the astronaut.
Was an astronaut, and I'm sure you know the case, that she traveled 900 miles, reportedly wearing a diaper, or not wearing a diaper, but she traveled 900 miles in what I could only call space rage. She was after the person who she felt had taken away her lover. And at the time that she was doing this, she didn't even herself understand how angry she was and what it was that was bothering her. But one of the reasons why crimes of passion are so significant and seem to evoke the greatest violence in people is because the desire to possess someone is really even greater than the desire to possess something.
Hmm.
Now, it might appear sometimes that a person is doing something for a reason, and They can explain what they're doing, but the truth is they're not conscious of it. So that what happens is it's the motivation that's unconscious, not the act itself. We know what we're doing. One example would be a person who wants to impress his father to get his approval. And even when he's 50, 60 years old, he's still telling his father of all the things he did. And he's not aware that he's trying to show his father that he's more successful than him, because in his unconscious, he still hates his father for not having praised him enough as a child. So we see the unconscious operating there. We see it operating in shoplifting. There's a case of a man who was having an affair with a woman, and his wife had no idea what was going on. The woman wanted him to leave his wife. He said he would, but he didn't. Finally, the woman got fed up, left him, and he got the bad news about that right before his wedding anniversary. But he didn't want to celebrate, because why should he celebrate? He really loved the other woman. So he went into a store to buy a card for his wife and some wrapping paper, but he didn't pay for it. Then he was caught, and he didn't understand why he did what he did. It wasn't at the conscious level. In fact, he had stole some things that had nothing to do with the wrapping paper, and the total value of what he stole was worth less than $30. So that sometimes people famous like Bess Meyerson, former Miss America, former director of consumer affairs, shoplift. People do other things wrong and not aware of them. As to Michael Vick, I think your caller is absolutely correct. It isn't simply a question of the environment you're brought up in. It's who you are. There are other people who were brought up in exactly the same circumstances as Michael Vick and didn't start a dog kennel that was based in part of that tolerated and that encouraged torturing animals, which he did. So at that sense, he has to take responsibility for that. It's not simply a question of the environment he was raised in.
One of the things you offer as a suggestion to all of us for avoiding bad decisions is gratitude, counting our blessings before sort of trying to even the score in ways that might be inappropriate.
Well, I think this is really a traditional question of the glass being half empty versus half full. I think we have to realize that certain things that happen to us are not as bad as we make them out to be. It may be part of our own personality. I'm talking about our individual makeup, to think of them as being terrible, but they're not. For example, if somebody assaults your sense of dignity, who heard it? Maybe it was a conversation between you and one other person. And how long will anybody remember it, even if they did hear it? Most people are too into what they're doing to think about what you're doing. And so I think that we have to understand that in many ways we're fortunate enough to have our lives, to have our health. And if you're always looking at what somebody else is doing, you will never be happy. There's no question about it, because there's always going to be someone who has more money than you, who's more famous than you, who's more powerful than you, and that is what I mean by counting your blessings.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Jason in Fort Worth. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are y'all?
Great, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question. I have a 15-year-old son, and there's an enigma that I'm kind of wrapped in with him and most of his friends, and we try to run a pretty tight ship at our house, and you made me actually feel better about being a parent, because I say that to him all the time, that everybody in this house loves you, but when you step out the door, nobody cares. And I've tried to teach him some things, you know, that to make good decisions, but he has this, and I almost think it's generational, this idea that not only is everything owed to them, but that they actually deserve it. And he comes up with some of the wittiest little comments that you almost can't argue with, and I found myself confounded with the response, but I can't convey the message to him in a way that he understands that at a certain point, very soon for him, because he is 15, he's going to be out in the world, and the merits that he brings to the table are what the rest of the world's going to judge him on, but I think that he still feels like it's just always going to be this nice little vacuum where everybody wants to take care of me, and I can't figure out a way to really push him in the right direction. I was just wondering what your thoughts on that were.
Well, this is really a great question, and it's a great question because it's something that so many people with parents, including myself, face, which is that the reason that we can't get our children to accept the fact that what they're doing is wrong is because most often the only way we learned it was wrong was through our own experiences. And when we tell our children, don't do that, I know better, we have to face the fact that they're not going to know better until they make the same mistakes that we made. After they make those mistakes, they'll come back to you, and they'll tell you when they're older that you were right. On the other hand, you do have to say something. You cannot abdicate responsibility, and you have to be able to say to your children, this is my position, this is how I feel, and this is why it's wrong. But once you've said that, don't keep repeating it, because the more you repeat it, the more desperate you're going to sound, and the more you'll feed in to the developing psyche that shows up around adolescence and that has to separate from parents and prove them wrong. You don't want to be in that kind of a catch-22 situation.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Back to Fort Worth this time. We have David on the line. Hi, David.
Hi. I just have a quick question for comment for your guest. I have a family member who cheated on a spouse, and as you can imagine, wove a tangled web of lies in that whole event. Now he's remarried. But it seems like the lying continues through the even the tiniest, most insignificant aspects of his life. For no reason, and I'm just wondering if your guest thinks that's typical, if you see that as typical, or if suggestions to get him out of that, because it's a great concern, obviously, for a family.
Yeah, Bill, you say lying is habit-forming.
I do say lying is habit-forming, and the reason is once we start lying, it's very, very hard to reconstruct our biography, to reconstruct our lives. Once we start to lie, it becomes almost a negation of our very selves when we start, you know, when we start trying to come clean. I'll give you an example of a famous person. Joseph Ellis was a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, taught at Mount Holyoke College, and used to regale his students with stories of his Vietnam War exploits. And then the Boston Globe did an interview with him. He had students who loved him, who worshipped him, who adored him, and they found out that he had not only had any exploits in Vietnam, he'd never even been there. He was teaching military history at West Point during the time of the Vietnam War. Now, was it any wonder, and this goes to the heart of your question about lying continuing, was it any wonder that he had not scored the winning touchdown for his high school football team? In fact, he wasn't even on the team. So the problem is that once you lie, especially if you're rewarded for it, in this case the students are laughing at his anecdotes, they're loving every minute of it, and they're hero worshiping him, it's very, very hard to give up that position. You got to start all over again. So that is the source of the idea of we weave a very tangled web when first we plot to deceive. I do not think that your friend is going to be able to get out of it so easily, because it's become a pattern. And we know that to change patterns, you have to start much earlier in life. He may be able to manage it, but he's not going to be able to change it.
What do you suggest to people? Do they need professional help if they are far down that road and don't really know how to...
You know, I'm very glad you raised that, because a lot of the time, we can't solve these problems ourselves. And what we have to recognize is that we do need professional help. And when you need professional help, a book can serve you as a guidepost. It can alert you to problems, but it can't do the whole thing. You need to be able to sit down with somebody, talk to them about your problems, and if you cannot solve them in terms of understanding why you did them, then, or if that does not help, then you need perhaps some kind of cognitive therapy where you engage in behaviors that, irrespective of getting to the cause, will stop you from doing it. Let's take a case like Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff, as you know, engaged in possibly the largest Ponzi scheme in history, and was brought to task for it. I think that the problem with Bernie Madoff is that he was, in all likelihood, a psychopath. A psychopath, by definition, is a person who does not have a conscience, who does not feel guilt about their actions. And everyone who has studied the matter will tell you that unless it is apprehended early in life, it really is very, very difficult to cure. How do we know he was a psychopath? Well, for one thing, he didn't mind bankrupting his sister, bankrupting the people who were closest to him, continuing to take money for people even after he knew the game was up. He didn't seem to care. And he was defiant even as he went off to jail, saying, I made these people money. Why are they bothering me? But But the truth is that the pattern had formed early in life. We see that because when he was still in college, he was involved in a crooked stock scheme working for his parents.
So you mentioned that for our own sake, we ought to cultivate relationships with people who will be straight with us and tell us, you know, when we're starting to go off course. How can we help our friends stay on the straight and narrow?
Well, we can help our friends by telling them the truth. They may be angry at you, but most people will recognize that the people who are telling them these things are not trying to hold them back, but are trying to help them. At that particular point, you have to be able to speak truth to power. You have to be able to tell the person. Most people do not really want to hear the praise, even though they say they do and even though they act like they do. What they really want to know is how to protect themselves and how to prevent themselves from getting into trouble. That really requires having friends who are not afraid to tell you what they think.
Have you observed any gender differences? Is it easier for men or for women to be straight with one another?
Yes, I have. It is my opinion that because women lack as much power in society as men, that they have become much more adept at communicating with each other and with other people. And if I have a communication issue, I always think I'm going to solve it better with a woman than with a man. And the reason is simply that men are trained to tough it out, to keep a stiff upper lip, and all the other stereotypes that go with playing that role. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work out that well.
What does it take to understand that nobody is perfect and nobody else's life that we think we envy is going along without a hitch?
What it takes to understand that is to understand that we are not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And that involves focusing on things that we've done wrong. People will ask me, did you ever do anything dumb? And I will tell them I did. I wouldn't be able to write about it if I hadn't.
Do you think students, I mean, is this a wisdom thing? Does it get easier over time?
It does get easier over time, but if there are certain basic personality problems that people have, then time does not necessarily heal it. In fact, time may harden it because you get into a rut, a pattern of response where you repeat the same behavior because it's what's worked for you superficially. But I have to tell you that you can always end up losing it, no matter who you are. I remember that I was coming home from work. I had worked very, very hard. It happened that the professors and
got about 5 seconds. I'm sorry.
I lost my temper. Somebody tried to rob me. I told them they could kill me. Luckily, they didn't.
I'm glad you're still here. The new book by William B. Helmreich is What Was I Thinking? Bill, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.